Okay, the time being 8:15, we will call the second meeting of the Health and Human Services Committee to order. We are just short of a quorum just yet, so when that comes in, I'll probably interrupt and ask for approval of the minutes. But until then, we will get on with the business that we have for today. I want to do something a little bit different in this committee than what we typically have for the overviews, the department overviews that committees generally go through the first couple hearings. And I wanted to learn more and talk more about the types of reports that the departments put together for us. Just asking that question, I learned that the departments put together over 70 reports every year for us. And so it'd probably be good to learn a little bit more about what they are doing there and how those reports affect the decisions we make, and hopefully identify some issues that we can work on coming forward this year. And so with that, I would like to call up Amy Delbo, Director of the Department of Human Services for Government Relations, and welcome to the committee. If you could please again state your name for the record and begin with your testimony.
Terrific. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Amy Delbo, Legislative Director, Government Relations for the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Thank you for having us today and also being able to spend some time with you. We have a couple documents, or one document actually, that we prepared that looks like this, and we're going to use that to walk through the reports that we do. I'll correct something, Mr. Chair. The number that I gave you was a biennial total, 70 reports roughly. So today, what we're covering are the recurring reports, so things that the legislature asked us to do annually or biannually. And we have about 38 reports that the department does either annually or biannually. We do have a number of reports that are one-time that are requested, and we're not covering those today, but those also feed into that that total. So with that, I wanted to orient you to the document a little bit so that you kind of could follow along. We have six business areas, and we ordered this document in the order of volume for the sake of getting most people out of the way early. And so direct care and treatment will be first, and you see that titled at the beginning. And then the title of the report is blue and bolded, and then it gives the reference in law for you, the next due date that the report will be due, and then the actual description in law so that you know what the report covers. And so we'll have a series of five individuals that will come up and talk about reports, or six individuals today. I'm covering the direct care and treatment, and so we'll start with that. Excuse me. So the first two reports are the Minnesota Sex Offender Program Annual Report, and this report was first requested in 2009. At the time, we had just finished a major bonding project up at the Moose Lake facility. It added 400 beds at that time. And then we also were expanding or enhancing the work that we were doing in community preparation services, which is a phase two of the sex offender treatment program. And that's at actually our St. Peter campus. Mm-hmm. At the time, we had four people that were in community preparation services, and now we have north of 50 people. And we actually have a bonding project, phase two, that we have before you, that where we're expanding community preparation services to accommodate those individuals that are moving through the treatment process. So at the time, there was a lot of activity going on with the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, and it actually was growing. And so the legislature had requested that we annually provide a description of the programming that we're doing, the mission and goals, as well as the program-wide per diem, so how much it costs per individual, and then annual statistics. And so that is that particular report. Then last year, we were requested to start a quarterly report on certain programs in the direct care and treatment area. These programs tend to focus specifically on our mental health services, and it's at our Anoka facility, Anoka Regional Treatment Center, as well as the Minnesota Security Hospital and our Community Behavioral Health Hospitals. And excuse me, this is an important part of the continuum of the mental health continuum, and a number of the mental health community stakeholders wanted to understand how many individuals that were able to accommodate in these facilities, what the occupancy rate was during the year, actually on a quarterly basis. And then also there has been a lot of discussion about some of the rate of injury that's occurring at the different facilities, whether or not we have sufficient staff, et cetera. So last year's legislature asked us to begin this quarterly report. We submitted the first report to you in November. And this report is fairly brief, but it talks about the census, any of the OSHA recordable injuries at each of these respective facilities, the clinical positions that we have available, and then those that are budgeted, and so that you can get a sense of how that's occurring. So with that, I'm just looking in the crowd. We're going to switch order a little bit. Nathan Morocco with healthcare. He has a meeting that he needs to attend to, so we'll navigate into a different part of the report. So I'll invite Nathan down. Are there any quick questions that folks would like me to entertain about these two reports, or was that sufficient?
It doesn't look like it, so please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Morocco, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and tell us about your reports.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Nathan Morocco. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Healthcare Administration at the Department of Human Services. So I have, I believe, about five reports. They're fairly straightforward. Is the mic on? I'm not sure.
Yes.
They're fairly straightforward, generally related to the business of the healthcare administration, which is the piece that I oversee. Just for some clarification then, that what that means is that I operate the Medicaid and the Minnesota Care programs for the state of Minnesota. Some of the reports are related to that part of the business, meaning contracts, networks, things of those sorts, to other sort of more operational components of the business, like call centers and processing of eligibility. So the first piece I would draw your attention to, it would be a report related to actuarial soundness.
And members, we're on page 8 of the packet here, if you're following along.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't have the handout, so I wasn't certain. So actuarial soundness is a term that's referred to as part of our managed care contracting. In essence, what it means is the rates that we produce for the capitated payments that go to the managed care organizations that provide the services for Medicaid and for Minnesota Care need to be actuarially sound, meaning that the rate that we pay the health plans needs to be rooted in sound science, meaning that the rate that we pay has to match our expectations regarding what the likely incurred costs would be for managed care, including everything from operational expenses, claims payments, and so forth. And so, in essence, what that report is are the letters from our actuaries, Milliman, describing the rates in the three main programs that we have that we develop rates for Medicaid. Second, Mr. Chair, we would have a summary of the independent health plan company audits. In essence, these are audits that are performed on behalf of external organizations. The last report was published in 2015. This is produced annually, December of each year, so we will have a new one. We are slightly delayed on that. And in essence, these are organizations that come in and look at some of the effectiveness of the health plans. Typically, these are national rating organizations or quality measurement organizations. Thirdly, Mr. Chair, would be the Minnesota Care Program Helpline Report. In essence, this would be a measurement or sort of a window into the kinds of calls that we take in our call centers at DHS. This would be anything from, our timeliness of calls, how many times people are calling and hanging up, sort of our ability to answer the questions that clients might have. There is one on here that we haven't produced, Mr. Chair, and to members of the committee. That is a report referred to as the Periodic Data Match Report, or PDM for short. And the reason that report has not been produced is because the PDM project itself has been delayed. There has been conversations between the agency and legislators about that. It was a piece of legislation that was passed very recently, but as a result of some IT complications, as well as some concerns around use of federal tax information, that project has been delayed. And again, in other committees and with other legislators, we've had that discussion between the agencies. So once the PDM project is up and running, we will then initiate that specific report. Mr. Chair, lastly would be a report on the state medical review team. This would really this reflects sort of an operational aspect of Medicaid. There are folks who can qualify for Medicaid if they qualify as disabled. And in order to determine if someone is disabled, we have to make that determination. It is possible that a determination can be made at the federal level through SSI. However, we at the state have the ability to make that same determination should, for any reason, someone choose not to go through the SSI route, or we can do it on a more expedited basis. So this report is intended to get at sort of our ability, the number of disability determinations that we make, sort of our ability to service the clients as they're referred to us, ensuring that the legislature has a window into, you know, that we are performing these disability determinations in a timely manner. So with that, Mr. Chair, that wraps up the brief reports that we have legislatively mandated or through executive order are required to come out of the Healthcare Administration.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Morocco, for that. Questions for Mr. Morocco? Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your presentation, Commissioner. The, you know, this area of Healthcare Administration, ever since I've been here, if I'm understanding this correctly, this has been a major point of controversy in terms of audit, the reserves, and what amount we're actually paying the plans to manage these areas. Okay? Would you agree with that?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think if you're referring to the managed care contracting process, certainly there has been activity in this area. So everything from sort of how we contract, which is really where the annual report on the managed care and Minnesota healthcare program report stems from. In there, it describes the program eligibility, sort of why we contract for managed care. It's actually, it's a long report. It's probably about 300 pages, but it is a good window into sort of how eligibility is maintained, determined, the role of the MCOs, how our contracting process itself. And then there has been recent discussions, in terms of the profits of the health plans, whether or not, you know, we're paying them appropriately, are they making too much money? There was a recent OLA report on the sort of administrative expenses of the managed care organizations, and are the payments made for administrative overhead reasonable? So, Representative, certainly there has been activity in these areas over the last few years.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, one of the allegations of those who criticize the plans on this process is that we don't really know what the administrative fees are based on the way we're auditing these programs, and that there's like a black box that we don't really know how the money goes. You do have providers complaining that they're being reimbursed at a rate much lower than what their costs are. And then on the other hand, you have critics saying that the administrative costs are fuzzy and we really don't know where the dollars are going versus the ones that we're putting in and going out. Do you believe we at the state have a firm handle on the administrative costs and where the money's actually going that goes through these programs?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I would say that we have a better handle on the cost than we have historically. So I think as a result of the activities within the healthcare administration to get at exactly what you're defining, which is what expenses are going towards healthcare, what expenses are going to administrative overhead. But I would be somewhat hesitant to use the word firm, only in that I think we need to come collectively to an agreement about what is administrative overhead versus what is a medical claim. So as an example, if a health plan is providing medical oversight, case management, if they're giving away free baby seats for new pregnant moms, I think one of the challenges that we have is that we don't necessarily regulate the health plans. That's the job of the Department of Health and the Department of Commerce. And so we're somewhat reliant on their ability to categorize where plan expenses are going and sort of what falls into what bucket. And I think the other challenge is that sometimes that reporting isn't necessarily consistent across all plans because there is a lack of universal definitions about what constitutes a medical claim versus an administrative claim and frankly sort of what's generally accepted as a reasonable profit by the health plan. So again, Representative, I'd say we're certainly better. I think there is more transparency than there has been, but I think you could just look to the last OLA report performed just a couple of years ago, and in there they were pretty upfront about the fact that it's difficult even for nobles in the OLA to really get at some of this information.
Final follow-up for Representative Grunhagen.
Thanks for that response, Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just, for new members, I think what's the total amount that goes through these programs in a year? I think it's $4 billion or $4.5
billion. Mr. Chair and Representative, that represents a good approximation, yes.
So it's not a small amount of money.
All right. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, everybody. Representative Grunhagen, I'm really glad to hear you asking about this. I think I hope that this session we will continue to delve into this issue because I think this is something just, for the new members and maybe for the public, this is something that I think there's some real bipartisan agreement around, that there is a lot of money going through this system, and that I think one of the things that's troubled all of us, and probably maybe this is something that you're kind of getting at, is that we don't have any control over the rates that are paid to providers under these programs. So this $4.5 billion, we take public money, a very large pot of public money. We have people who are on public programs, and we take our money and pay it to organizations who are not under our control. And so when we, for example, raise a rate for dentistry, we say, oh, my goodness, our Medicaid patients are not getting the dental care that we think they should be, and we raise the rate. We have no way of making sure that rate increase goes to the people that we intend it for. And that creates a lot of frustration. The public believes that we legislators are in control, and the reality is that we are not. But what we are in control of is having this system all together, and I will be putting forward a bill. I'm just tweaking it with the revisor's office. I had it last session, too, to take back our public programs from the HMOs. We've been creating, over the years, different systems, provider systems, to manage people's health care in a much better way. And we have wonderful county-based purchasing systems which do this much better, more efficiently than the HMOs do. And so, what my bill is going to propose is that we simply take out the middleman so that we, the legislators, gain back some control of what's going on. And that I believe that the time has come to move away from this very inefficient system where we don't even know what we're paying for administrative costs for multiple entities. And then because of our competitive bidding process, which has improved things a bit, it has squeezed out some of the excess profit, if you will. These are nonprofits. They don't have profit, right? They have leftover money at the end. But that's improved things, but now we have a lot of expense and a lot of administration in that contracting process. And we still don't have – we're paying for multiple administrative costs for a lot of different entities. And I think that we can redesign the system and do better. And we're going to have to. My final point is that, as we speak, Congress is repealing the Affordable Care Act. Well, like it or hate it, the Affordable Care Act has put a lot of money into our programs here. We stand to lose a ton of money, and yet we're going to be called upon by our citizens to continue giving, you know, making sure people have health care. And how are we going to do that? We're going to have to find a way to be much more efficient with our programs in order to continue with what our constituents expect of us. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative.
I'm just curious, what order of business are we on? I was just trying to follow everything.
We are, Mr. Morocco is taking questions.
Oh, thank you,
about
sir.
The reports he has there. Thank you, Representative Carisha. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Morocco, you had touched on the actual actuarial soundness. Is there ever a report that gets back or information within a report that looks back at the assumptions and projections and whether that calculation is within the uncertainty that would be expected? It seems as if oftentimes after the fact we're surprised by things. So I was just wondering if they go back and do a verification of what work they've done.
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I want to make sure I understand the question. Are you asking if we go back after the fact and review whether actuarial soundness was accurate?
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, that's I'm used to every year when we make new projections, we try to understand the soundness of our calculations, the assumptions, you know, et cetera. Do we have variables that we haven't taken into account so that we can do a better job of understanding and projecting? And I was just trying to see if that's part of the SOP of the organization, if that is also transmitted back so the legislature can understand, better clarity when we're told something, what the uncertainty is.
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, thank you for the clarification. So the rate memo itself is quite detailed in terms of the assumptions that went into setting the rate. In fact, I think if you look at the current report for PMAP, that rate assumption report is probably about 130 to 150 pages long. And it would go through great detail about sort of various assumptions, geographic regions, age, current sort of high-cost cases. It would be emerging legislation, things that have recently passed, the likelihood of the impact of that. So to Representative Liebling's point, you know, when the legislature passes certain kinds of mandates, certain kinds of preferences around different types of services, whether it be mental health or dental, all of those assumptions are in there. That said, however, Representative, certainly there are emerging rate issues that do arise even after the fact. And so we have from time to time even gone back into those contracts and made sort of mid-year adjustments if it looks like something, you know, was grossly inaccurate or could not have been foreseen. I guess the latter being more typical. So that would be, I think, how we have approached that historically. But the rate memos themselves would provide just about every assumption that we would have in the rate itself. And by design, that's what the actuarial soundness is designed to do, because the managed care organizations are bearing risk, and the state is paying a significant amount of money for the managed care. The rules under CMS sort of want to make sure that we're not overpaying or underpaying for the services. We don't want an MCO to be able to come in and underbid for business purposes, nor do we want to intentionally overpay an MCO, beyond that, what we would reasonably expect.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If it was possible to get a copy to add to my light reading list, and then also it appears we have a quorum, I'd like to move the minutes.
We will officially call the meeting to order. Representative Quam moves the minutes. Are there any additions or corrections to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of adopting the minutes for January 10th, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
The motion is adopted. Let's see. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Morocco, it's my understanding that you review applications, and do you have a system that kind of flags an application to say, hey, maybe this one doesn't belong here at all?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, are you referring to, like, eligibility to be on public health care programs?
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair and Representative, so eligibility is managed at several levels. So first we would have to think about the various programs. So eligibility, as an example, for PMAP is going to work differently than it would for a seniors or disability program. You know, the bulk of our programs are PMAP, the sort of basic medical care under MA, Medicaid. The Minnesota Eligibility Technology System handles a lot of that. But then as we get into more sort of hand-to-hand kind of enrollment eligibility determinations, the DHS office here in St. Paul and up in Brainerd manage the Minnesota Care eligibility. So we are really sort of the direct conduit for Minnesota Care. The counties would then be responsible for the Medicaid portion. So they're really the ones that are interfacing with the client, helping them through the eligibility process. Beyond that, then there would be other resources. So we would get referrals coming in from brokers that are helping somebody on the individual market. And they may come across clients that appear to be eligible for public programs. They might refer into them. Similarly, a navigator role, which is intended to get out into the communities and try to find people that are eligible for public programs as well as for advanced payment tax credits.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Morocco. The reason I'm asking is I ran into a person this fall who was really quite upset about how her application was handled. She wanted to enroll into MNSHR. And what happened is because she doesn't have an income, because she's early retired, basically, she's around 60, let's say, and she can afford to not work. When she went in to enroll in MNSHR, she was told she couldn't because she didn't have an income and there was no check of assets. So they enrolled her in Medicaid. And she's like, well, I don't want to be there. I want to be here. And the response was, well, you can't because you don't have an income. Well, then she found out quite a bit later that she also had a lien placed on her home. So then what her next plan was now to withdraw from her retirement, take the hit, pay the penalties, but to show an income so that she could get off Medicaid and go on to MNSHR. So the reason, you know, I'm just really concerned, do we have any more checks that look at this and say, hey, we need to do something else. Maybe we should add an asset check onto what we're doing, you know, with enrollment to MNSHR. And that was just really surprising to me that somebody who can afford to not have an income gets put on Medicaid.
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, thank you. It certainly sounds like the client received some poor information, but I would say that in terms of assets, it is by design a non-asset eligibility. So it really is based on projected income. That means somebody could have assets, but if their actual income, if they don't receive income off of those assets, it certainly is possible to qualify for Medicaid, meaning then that they would not qualify for any of the tax credits if they were looking for an individual product. But they certainly would be free to purchase any product from a broker. They would also be they would have the ability to purchase a qualified health plan on the exchange. But so from that perspective, it sounds like they got some bad information. But, again, by design, under the new rules of Medicaid, it is not an asset-based test for Medicaid, for the basic health plan of Medicaid.
Follow-up, Representative Tice?
Just one. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Morocco. I think it's just kind of scary to me that we're putting people who are financially doing very well, and we're putting them on Medicaid because there is no asset test. I mean, it's just really alarming to me that that's what we're doing. But thank you.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Morocco, is this report that you speak of the kind of the first issuance that will occur in February, or I don't recall when that citation was made part of statute.
Ms. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and to the representative, are you referring to, because we've talked about the actuarial soundness and we've talked about
the state medical review team, Mr. Chair.
Oh, the SMERC.
Morocco.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I have, let me just look. So the last report was done for the SMERC in fiscal year 15. It was published in February of 2016. and the next report will be available in February.
Mr. Chair, thank you. After its delivery to the chairs and ranking minority leaders, is that also available online?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, actually it's been exclusively online since fiscal year 09. And I think to the other representative's point, too, we'd be happy to provide the links. They're all available online. So, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to make that available to the committee if that's easier.
Thank you, Ms. Brown, for that.
Some of them are quite lengthy. Like I said, the managed care report is probably 300-plus pages, so maybe better suited for online viewing than printing.
I think that would be appreciable, Mr. Chair, so thank you for indulging me with that.
All right, thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Morocco? Seeing none, Ms. Morocco, thank you for your time this morning and the report that you gave us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name and introduce yourself for the committee, and then tell us about your reports.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Carrie Benson. I am the Director of the Aging and Adult Services Division at the Department of Human Services. And in that role, I also serve as the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board on Aging. So we'll be going back to page 2 in your handout of the reports. And I will be going over the 4 reports that are listed under Continuing Care for Older Adults. The first report that I will provide an overview of is the Annual Dementia Grants Progress Report. This report is a required report of the Minnesota Board on Aging, and it is required to provide updates and a progress report on the grants funded under the state-funded Dementia Grants Program. The report submitted this year, which will be submitted just next week, is the first report under this legislation. And it will report on the grants funded under this legislation, funded through the $1.5 million that is received for this program. The funds are distributed through a competitive RFP process to community organizations to do several things: increase awareness of Alzheimer's disease, increase the rate of cognitive testing, promote the benefits of early diagnosis, connect family and friend caregivers with education and resources. So the report will include for this year and following years, it'll include information on each of the grant recipients, summaries of their projects, measurable outcomes established by each grantee, and an explanation of the results that they expect to achieve and the evaluation that they will do over the course of their grants, and an accounting of how the grant funds were spent. So this year, being the first period of funding for this program, we have 20 grantees. They're about midway through their contract year. We do have a few highlights to show you at this, to share with you at this time, and then we'll have the more detail in the report that we'll be submitting next week. So far, they have reached, the 20 grantees have reached more than 10,000 people with education and training regarding Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. They have reach those individuals with information about services and resources. And in particular, they have reached 450 caregivers with information about services that they can use to help support them in their role as a family or friend caregiver. And over 700 people suspected to have or diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease and other dementias have also been reached with information about resources for them, education for them, and for their family members. The second report that I will provide an overview of is the Vulnerable Adult Maltreatment Annual Report. This annual report is compiled by the Vulnerable Adult Maltreatment Reconsideration Review Panel. The panel is established to give vulnerable adults or an interested party to the vulnerable adult an opportunity to have a final investigative determination of the lead investigative agency reviewed by the panel. In 2016, the panel received 6 requests to review final investigative determinations of the lead investigative agencies. This resulted in lead investigative agencies changing their final determination 2 times. And this is about the average number of requests that this panel receives per year, and about average 2 in terms of the number of cases that are changed in terms of that final determination. This report will also be submitted next week. It will include the number of requests for review the panel receives under this section, which I just shared with you, number of cases where the panel requires the lead agency to reconsider its final disposition, number of cases where the final disposition is changed, and then the recommendations to improve the review or investigative process. The third report that I will describe for you is the long-term care biannual report. This report describes the status of the full range of long-term services and supports that support older adults, people with disabilities, children, and adults living with mental illnesses. So for those four populations, we provide a range of information in this biannual report. The report addresses the demographics of these four populations, measures their need for long-term care services and supports. It provides a county and regional perspective across the state on the gaps in services, surpluses, imbalances, and then the corrective action plans related to addressing those gaps in particular. We also provide the status of services by county and region, including changes in the availability of long-term care services and supports and housing options, access problems, comparative measures of long-term care service availability, and recommendations regarding goals for future long-term care services and supports, policy and fiscal changes, and resource development and transition needs. The last two components of this report, really focusing on the system itself, is fulfilled primarily by the completion of a biannual gaps analysis, survey process, and study process. The primary components of the gaps analysis process are surveys that are completed by the lead agencies, counties, tribes, and managed care organizations. But through that process, we also collect perspectives of people who receive services and other stakeholders. So we bring that all together into this report to highlight, trends that we might see in the service system overall, and where there are gaps identified, especially by multiple sources, are highlighted. An additional component that we're including this year, leading up to the submission of this report in August, will be a convening of regional meetings to bring the stakeholders together that I mentioned are part of providing their information, their perspectives on the status of the system and the supports. We will bring them together. We'll provide additional information from our data systems about service use and service capacity overall. And we'll bring folks together to develop collaborative action plans to address the gaps. So that's a new component for this year's report. The final report that I will go over for you is the Home and Community-Based Services Transition Plan Annual Report. The transition plan is needed for DHS to work towards full compliance with the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Home and Community-Based Settings Rule. The rule was released in 2014, and it requires that all older adults and people with disabilities who receive Medicaid-funded home and community-based services receive those services in the most integrated setting and that they have full access to the benefits of community living. So there's several aspects to the rule that we are required to implement, and we need to have each of these pieces in place by March 17, 2019, or before. These include assurances that all people have information and experiences with which to make informed decisions about their services and supports and how those are received and where. Services people must receive need to meet a prescribed set of standards that are laid out in the rule. People should receive person-centered planning and conflict-free case management. For Minnesota, the rule applies to the following waiver programs, Medicaid, or as we call it in Minnesota, medical assistance programs, waiver programs, brain injury, community alternative care, community access for disability inclusion, developmental disabilities waiver, elderly waiver, and the alternative care program. This report will detail the status of the implementation of the transition plan by identifying key strategies to meet the requirements of the federally mandated rule and highlighting operational activities that we will be undertaking in this coming year and so on. We will be providing information and technical assistance to lead agencies and case managers as they implement their part of the rule. And we will be working very closely with providers who are working towards making necessary changes that they might need to make to come into full compliance with the rule. So we'll continue to report on our progress annually during the transition period, and that is ending on or before March 17, 2019. Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Benson, for your overview of reports. Are there any questions for Ms. Benson? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your time this morning and the information you provided us.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your information.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Christopher Orr, and I'm the Legislative Director for the DHS-wide Policy and Operations Administration. The administration produces six annual or biannual reports, many of which are relatively new in the last few years. The first report on your list is the maltreatment report for vulnerable adults and minors served by Minnesota licensed providers. This is a biennial report. However, the department does annually post data to its website on its maltreatment reports. Reporting on maltreatment was established in 1995, among other statutory reforms to maltreatment investigations. The scope of the report has expanded over the years to the seven components that are now incorporated in the description in the handout you received. DHS and the Department of Health provided individual reports until 2014, when the legislature eliminated those requirements and established the joint report that is now produced. The second report that the administration produces is Managed Care and County-Based Purchasing Plan Ad Hoc Audit Report. In 2015, the legislature required the commissioner, to the extent of available funds, to conduct ad hoc audits of the state public health care program, administrative and medical expenses reported by the managed care plans and county-based purchasing plans. This report was established at the same time as that requirement. The third report is the Human Services Performance Management System. The report details the work of the Human Services Performance Management System. The system was established in 2013 in response to the county's desire to be proactive in improving service delivery and outcomes for human service program recipients. The Human Service Performance Management System currently reports on five areas: child welfare, child support, cash and food support, Minnesota Family Investment Program, and Diversionary Work Program. New areas of human service performance are added each year. In 2017, the focus will be on mental health. The fourth report is the Culture on Ethnic Communities Leadership Council annual report. The Leadership Council was established in 2015. The council's purpose is to advise the commissioner on ways to understand and help close the significant gaps in health outcomes between most Minnesotans and the state's communities of color. The report covers the work of that council over the past year. The report on interagency agreements and interagency transfers is the fifth report. This is a relatively new report established last session, in the 2016 legislative session. This report is provided on a quarterly basis. It provides transparency for the legislature and public on the department's interagency agreements. It includes details and explanations of transfers between the department and other agencies. And the final report that the administration produces is the dedicated funds report. The department manages a number of dedicated funds and accounts. This report details the state fiscal year beginning balances for those accounts and the activity that takes place in those accounts in that time frame. That concludes the reports from the administration.
All right. Questions for Mr. Orr? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your report. I just a little clarification. the one that you were calling human service performance is on our sheet here. It says annual county performance. I mean, I know the counties deliver a lot of these services, but could you just clarify? I don't know why.
The council is the annual county performance. The County Performance Management Council, the system is the that's a part of the performance system. So the report is really on the operations and the activities of the system as a whole. So I believe I received a late minute edit and it didn't get on the sheet. Sorry about that.
Thank you. Thank you,
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that brings up the question about, METS, the data entry, and the difficulties the counties have had to add personnel. Does the report go over some of the, issues encountered that have maybe degraded the, services? If it takes many hours more than to do something than you could do in 5 minutes in the past, does it highlight those type of issues?
Mr. Orr.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's something that I would need to go back and get a little more information on in terms of to what degree the impact of the activities of METS for the counties is considered, taken into consideration for that report.
A later follow-up needed there. Any other questions for Mr. Orr? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your time this morning, Mr. Orr. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jim Koppel. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services, and I'll run through our reports, beginning with the annual Child Protection Quality Assurance Review summary. This report is incorporated in the next one that I'll cover, but just to give you the details of what this particular piece is, it covers, we go out and review cases in all of the counties. We move through all of the counties over a period of 3 years, but we review their cases. We go through how they made their decisions and then have discussions with counties on any reports or any cases that we think merit that discussion to just make sure we are, that this is a goal of uniformity of practice across the state. So that report is, and that information is included in the next annual Child Maltreatment and Out-of-Home Placement report. And this report generally covers two areas, maltreatment and out-of-home placement. We divided that into two reports this year just because it's clearer when we do it that way. We think we kind of reformatted it. We, for those of you who get an opportunity to look it over, I think it's a lot better information, more readable, friendlier to the reader in terms of information, charts, graphs, et cetera. So that's the annual Child Maltreatment Out-of-Home Placement Report. The Homeless Youth Biannual Report, the third one on the list, is a list of the areas of the state where the greatest, it tells us about the areas of the state where there's the greatest need for our services and housing for homeless youth. It details the grants that were made, how the funds were distributed on a population need. Follow-up information is available on whether they have stable housing after 2 years after services are provided. And then other outcomes that show effectiveness of the program, of the grants that were given out and how what results they produced. Next is the annual report, rates of referral for screening under the Individuals with Disability Education Act. This is specifically, this is related to child protection. When a family is referred to child protection, they are also told that these services are available. This is part of the county's responsibility, so we follow up to see how many referrals counties made. These aren't required services. In other words, they are helpful services to families, but families aren't required to take them, much like this is the Part C referrals that early intervention referrals that a lot of kids get through the local boards of education as well. So that report just covers how the counties handle screening and referrals. The next one is the Child Protection Disparity Grants Process Evaluation Biannual Report. This is a new report that we just finished the process last year of, if you recall, part of the funding for in 2015 for child protection, there was additional $26 million was given out annually for child protection. $1.5 million per year of that was for disparity grants. So these are those disparity grants that have been allocated, and you know, the RFP process went through. We made the awards, and in August of this year, August 1st, there was a typo on your originally. So August 1st of this year will be that first report coming back on the progress and results of those initial grants. And then we have the biannual child support performance report. And this, you know, is a basically shows how we're doing by counties, by as a state. I will say that Minnesota does very well nationally. We're always in the top five almost for every measurement there is. We have a very, very, very sound, good child support system, and we're constantly making improvements to it. That's one of the reasons why I think it remains in the top five. And in the next report, the quadrennial child support guidelines review every 4 years, the next report will be coming in 2018. But there's a child support task force that was created last year, and that task force, with the help of an economist that was retained as part of that work, we'll be looking at and reviewing all of our how we estimate or produce the specific support, economic support, by income, by family size, by the types of jobs, et cetera. Review our entire system and say, what could we improve? Where could it be improved? And how can we increase participation? Because we think this part of our work is very important for two parents to be involved in the economic support of their children. We think it's just something that's had great bipartisan support over the years and is reflected in the creation of this task force last year, and look forward to that result. And the next and last report is actually a report beginning in February of the activities of that task force. So the task force itself will have a report, and they will also help us, just timing-wise, with this quadrennial child support report, which happens to be every 4 years, so they both will come in together next year. So in 2018, you'll be getting both of these reports. And with that, that concludes reports in my area.
All right. Questions for Mr. Koppel? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your time this morning.
Thank you.
All right, members, we have one last area to go over this morning. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and tell us about your reports.
Certainly. My name is Claire Wilson. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of the Community Supports Administration, and we have 12 different reports in this administration, covering three of the divisions within the administration: the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division, the Mental Health Division, and the Disability Services Division. So the first three that I'll cover fall under the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division, the first being our report on that division's work, so the biennial report on the work that we're doing to strengthen the continuum of services in Minnesota, on the outcomes of those services, and then on the barriers for access to treatment. This most recent report does contain some of the work that the division has been doing over the last 2 years in terms of leading conversations around the state that include both providers, those who access treatment, counties, tribes, and others to really start to think about how we can reform the system. We are also reporting back on a legislative directive to pilot some of those reforms, so some direct access to treatment. Those pilots are primarily happening in northwestern Minnesota. And then also just recommending advancements that we can make in the system that include advanced care coordination, looking at peer recovery services, and other areas where we recognize that there have been gaps in the continuum of care for substance use disorder treatment. The next two reports, one which is an all relate to problem, both relate to problem gambling. The first is an annual report that is primarily generated to look at what are revenues generated within the within gambling that are generated by those with problem gambling. And then the other is to look more broadly at the status of problem gambling within the state. So we've combined those two reports, and they examine both our progress towards addressing the problem, again, some of the barriers towards addressing the problem, and really looking at the significant impact that problem gambling has, not just in the lives of the individuals who are affected, but within their families and the ways it impacts our, you know, sort of greater social fabric. This report will contain multiple recommendations, and that includes increasing our education and prevention efforts around problem gambling, increasing our ability to actually collect and examine data about the amount of revenue that's generated by those who are experiencing problem gambling, and then really conducting a study to assess the prevalence of problem gambling. We do at this point believe it's close to 4.4% of the population suffers from problem gambling. The next report is moves us to our mental health division. So, and this is a biannual report on our adult mental health grants. So these grants are authorized to really ensure that we have a statewide continuum and availability of services. These go to our counties who provide and are really they are the state's mental health authority, and they are the backbone of the state's safety net. So these grants both ensure that there are fewer gaps in the continuum. They strengthen areas that are ancillary services that may not be covered by Medicaid. They help with people who experience underinsured, who are underinsured and so may not have access to all the mental health benefits that are available. And they also assist with Minnesotans who may not have access to insurance. This report also speaks to the gaps in the continuum of care. And the top four gaps that were identified are a lack of inpatient adult psychiatric beds, which will come as no surprise to anybody who's served on this committee before, a lack of psychiatric prescribers, which we know that we have a serious workforce crisis facing the mental health, the field of mental health. Permanent supportive housing. So people with mental illnesses, when they are trying to access housing, they often need supportive services to allow them to maintain that housing. And counties have increasingly identified the lack of availability of permanent supportive housing as one of the gaps in the continuum. And then finally, intensive residential treatment services, or IRTSs, as you'll hear them referred to throughout the session. And these are short stays that provide for stabilization. And it can either serve as a step down from a hospital discharge, or it can serve as a prevention to a hospitalization, or perhaps to an interaction with corrections or a more costlier intervention. The next report is the biannual evaluation of our children's mental health grants. So these, similar to the adult mental health grants, are grants that are authorized and mandated to help strengthen the capacity to provide the services, so working with providers, and then for delivering effective service to children with severe mental illness. there is a lot of capacity that needs to be built into our children's mental health system, which is somewhat ironic since all these children will actually grow into the adults who we will end up spending quite a lot of money on later on down the line. So these grants are really important to ensuring access to different services, and out of this pool comes the SchoolLink mental health grants, which we know have been very successful in allowing providers to partner with schools to provide services where the kids are when they need them. The next biennial report shifts us into our Disability Services Division. Now, this is a report that reports back on the goals and priorities of the Disability Services Division. This is a very large report. I would really encourage you to read it if you have the opportunity. You might have a little downtime. This is an area which is experiencing both significant pressures from the federal government to transform in order to make sure that we're having integration in the community that looks and feels like informed choice and meaningful access to services that meet people where they need to be. So as we've moved from institutionalization into community settings, we're now into that moment in time where we're ensuring that where people work and live also do not have the characteristics of an institution, but allow people an opportunity to really be fully integrated into their community. That is the work of this division. It works through multiple ways to achieve those goals, and I would encourage you to learn more about the different ways that's happening, and we'll have many conversations about it this session, I'm sure. The next report is the Annual Disability Waiver Rate Setting Report, or DWRS. Now, DWRS is the payment system for disability services in Minnesota. It launched in 2014. It launched because CMS had found us, or the Center for Medicaid Services, had found us out of compliance in terms of the way our rate-setting methodology for disability services. So in response to that, we worked to launch this tool, for setting rates. It's a tool that has a base methodology that includes wages and different base, and then is responsive to the unique needs of the individual so that we're making sure that rates are set based on the need. It is a program. It is a tool that is still in transition. There's still some banding to historical rates. There's still some budget neutrality factors that create artificiality in terms of the increase and the decrease of the rates. But it is a work in progress, and this report really brings us to talk about where we are at this moment in implementation. It will not be fully implemented until 2019 or 2020, depending on if we are allowed another extended year of banding. The next two reports also relate to disability services, and they're best to speak to them in a combined way because it's the quarterly waiting list data report and the monthly financial data report. So both of these reports sort of report on how we're allocating resources to the waivered programs and then how people are gaining access to those programs. And so counties are authorizing funds and services for people with disabilities who are trying to access the waivers. So one report reports on how those resources are being authorized and if there's been any underspending. And then the next addresses the wait list. And I am, though this current report does not reflect that, I am proud to say that the CADI waiver, or the Community Access for Disability Inclusion waitlist, has been eliminated. Yay. And that we are now continuing to work on the woohooed, yay! Well, I rarely get that. So, yes, that's a big woohoo, actually. And then the final report that I will just speak briefly to is, or actually it's not the final, I'm sorry, the second to last. We're almost there. Is the Consumer Satisfaction Report. Assistant Commissioner Morocco spoke to the Minnesota Care Helpline, that part of the report. I'll just speak very briefly to the Disability Linkage Line. So that is another helpline that we operate. We also looked at the call volumes and adjusted some of our hours based on that. But more importantly, really, we did a survey, a satisfaction survey. 97% indicated the disability linkage line was helpful. 94% said they learned something new from the disability linkage line. And 96% said they would recommend the disability linkage line. And this is really, I wanted to draw your attention to this because as you are asked about resources from constituents, this is a very helpful resource. It not only links people to resources, per its name, but it also can help provide ongoing support and help people as they're accessing and coordinating those services. So I strongly recommend the Disability Linkage Line if it's not on your radar. And the last report is the Initiatives to Improve Early Screening, Diagnosis, and Treatment of Children with Autism Spectrum Disorder and Other Developmental Conditions Annual Report. And this report has been handled by various parts of the agency as our relationship to autism and our development of an autism benefit has been ongoing. The Disability Services Division is now producing that report and is working with stakeholders to make it a bit more plain language and more clear. So that report will be produced and finalized within the next few months. And that concludes the reports from the Community Supports Administration.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Wilson? Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Wilson, for your report. Yeah, just a couple things on the gambling. I think you said 4.4% of the population is suffering with some level of addiction as far as gambling is concerned. If, you know, I just took 5 million people times 4%, that's, you're talking about 200,000 people in the state of Minnesota. I mean, that's not any small number. So what are we, you talked about educating the public. Are we putting neon signs outside of, just outside casinos, warning gambling can be detrimental to your economic and mental health? Or what are we doing in the terms of the education? You know, we got the state promoting the lottery, which is contributing, I'm sure, to the 200,000 people having a problem. Do they put any type of... You know, we put warning on cigarettes. We try to limit intake of alcohol. What are we doing in this area to warn people about the potential consequence? Because I've seen families in my own district do criminal behavior. It's broken up families, led to divorce, based on a huge gambling problem. So what are we actually doing?
Ms. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for that question. So there's a couple of different ways in which we are conducting public awareness and education campaigns. It includes a website. It includes a helpline. It includes collaborating with the North Star Gambling Alliance to do public education campaigns. The gambling industry also does some public awareness campaigns separate from the department-administered education and awareness campaigns. Certainly, there's always more that we can do in that area, and this report does recommend, you know, further and additional campaigns to do that. You're correct that it has a significant impact. Of that 4.4%, 1% is accessing treatment services or clinical services. So in addition to the prevention and awareness, the state is also operating treatment services.
Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Yeah, it'd be interesting to collaborate the study of mental illness to gambling addiction, how many people having gambling addiction and their family members fall into the mental illness area, because it brings severe tragedies and consequences to the families based on my observation. Last question is, the to what degree do the tribes that run casinos cooperate with us in trying to identify and limit people that they observe having an addiction or developing a problem?
Ms. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the tribes are our partners along with the counties in the administering treatment and in our education campaigns. I can't speak directly to their own initiatives in terms of identifying problems within their facilities.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question's a lot less interesting than that. So I just, because you're the last person to present, I'm just kind of curious. I mean, we obviously, it takes a lot of resources to produce all these reports. And this is just a, I know these aren't all of them, I'm sure. I mean, you know, so I'm just kind of wondering if you could just give us a sense of what the process is within the department for these things. Like, are these, obviously we've had different assistant commissioners from different areas of DHS, and are, do you all kind of, do you have to have, you just appoint a staff member to be the point person on each of these different reports? Do you have a section within your division that does reports? I'm just kind of curious to understand how you all manage this, you know, besides doing the actual work that underlies all of this, which I think we've gotten a little taste of that today, how much is involved. This is just telling us about it. You know, can you or another person here just kind of give us that overview?
Ms. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I can certainly attempt to do so. Luckily, I'm the newest assistant commissioner, so I can tell you what happens within my administration. But certainly within the divisions, subject matter experts are assigned who are working on these different areas are assigned to work on the reports. They work with our data and research folks who are, you know, ingrained within the administration. It is a lot of work to collect these reports. And then, of course, we're working in partnership with anyone else who we need to collect data from to provide the report. And then it goes on to, you know, be approved and with the division directors and then eventually up through the administration.
Representative Liebling?
Thank you. So there's no sort of division of report production. It's just that a person gets assigned who's a subject matter expert where a report is required, and then they manage it and gather the information and so on. And is there some sort of a template that people use, at least something that helps, you know, so that it isn't reinventing the wheel?
Ms. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, as far as I know, there is a standard template for our annual and biennial reports. Whether that, when they kind of plug into that template, I'm not sure, but there is a standardized way that we end up reporting. I don't know if, yeah.
Welcome back, Ms. Delwell.
Mr. Chair and members, Amy Delwell, Department of Human Services, and Representative Liebling. I think in terms of the reports, some of them we've done for a long time. There are policy staff across the department, and you will, you know, see that there's various policy staff that are coordinating not only the production of the reports, but we have a myriad of advisory councils and stakeholder groups, et cetera, where we're gathering information. And so there are times that we are asked to produce these reports within existing resources, and we try to embed that in the work. There are times that these reports are more substantial, and then we do request funds from the legislature in order to dedicate an individual to gathering that type of information and producing that report. It generally takes several different divisions to produce a report. You know, when we have financials, it involves our reports and forecasts area. It also involves our systems area at times to produce that. So it's a collective effort, and so there are different times where, and that's where you'll see when we say, yes, we have an individual that we can, you know, continue to produce this report. Or there are times that we come back with a fiscal request and say, we don't have the bandwidth to produce this report without some additional support, and then request that support.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And excuse me, this is a question for Ms. Wilson, I guess. I've been visiting with a number of our home and waivered service folks back in the Wilmer Canyon County area, and trying to find a way to keep their employees going, and their pay is extremely critical to a low level right now that we need to work on. I'm looking forward to working with my colleagues here about that this year. But I will tell you that it has come up with the waiver rate setting process. And can you go a little bit further for me anyway about, you mentioned earlier that there could be another year delay or year extension. How does that process work? When will that be determined? who determines that? And again, I'm actually one of the nerds here that wants to look at this report that you said we should look at, because I need to do that. It is a lot of information, but it's important that we understand this. So if you just give me a little bit of that information on the waiver thing.
One of the nerds, Ms. Wilson.
Yes, I am. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker. So currently the rates are banded to their historical rates in order to kind of manage this transition period. CMS did have to approve that banding. We do have a waiver currently into CMS that requests, so we got 5 years of banding. We do have a waiver request into CMS for a 6-year of banding. And that waiver amendment has been submitted. We are just waiting on approval from CMS.
Mr. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. And are you confident that waiver should take place, that extension?
Ms. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker, I always hesitate to say how confident I feel about what CMS will or will not do, but we do feel fairly certain that we will get a 6-year, but I can't say yes or no.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions for Ms. Wilson or Ms. Zowo? Seeing none, the committee thanks you. Ms. Delwo.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to share with the committee that we will send to Ms. Larson the links to our website so that you can draw down any of the reports that you're interested in. In addition to that, all of the reports that we produce are sent to the Legislative Reference Library. They're logged there electronically, as well as we send 2 hard copies to the reference library so that they have that physical copy on file. So I just wanted to make that mention. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And with that, we are adjourned.